It is 8:31. We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right, a lot to cover today. A lot happened this last week.
Yeah, very busy.
Of note. Starting with right here in town, Mayor Ed Murray.
Yeah. Oh, the minimal wage proposal.
The minimal wage. The 15 not yet wage proposal. Ed Murray announced his so-called $15 per hour minimum wage proposal this week. He said that it was hammered out by the majority of his Income Inequality Advisory Committee. 21 of the 24 members agreed to it.
Including all of the labor reps.
Yeah, which is kind of interesting.
We'll get back to that.
The proposal has four tiers of employers, two tiers of small, quote-unquote small businesses. And I say quote-unquote small businesses because when I think of small businesses, I think of, you know, businesses with employees under 50 or 100, you know. But here what defines small business is any business that has employees under 500 total.
In the city of Seattle.
In the city of Seattle. The two tiers for the small businesses, basically they have 5 to 7 years to get to $15 an hour, depending on whether or not they count tip credits and they offer healthcare benefits.
And that's 5 to 7 years starting at the end of 2015.
Yeah. And then two tiers for big business, which is the same, you know, businesses that are over 500 employees, they have 3 to 4 years to get to the $15 an hour minimum wage. Now, I looked at this, and my problem with this proposal is the same as Shama Sawant's problem with this proposal, is that first off, this idea that you'd phase it in over a number of years was an idea that was presented for small businesses. It was not presented for all businesses. However, here in this proposal, it's all businesses. And in my mind, big businesses, those that have over 100 employees would be my threshold. My generous, what I think of as a generous
and
threshold.
And that was Sawant's proposal as well.
Yeah. Would be able to pay and should pay $15 an hour minimum wage starting immediately. That's not what's in this proposal. I think most telling was the admission by Howard Wright, who kind of led up the committee. He's with the Seattle Hospitality Group. They own a lot of hotels in town. He said that one of his three main goals when he agreed to sit on the advisory committee was to include, and this is a direct quote, additional forms of income above and beyond straight wages. That means counting your tips
yeah.
from customers as well as the wage your employer pays and counting healthcare benefits.
They wanted to set that precedent because tip penalties, which is to say it's called tip credits, Washington is one of only six states in the country that does not allow that right now. And statewide, they wanted to set the precedent so that they can go down, big business can go down to Olympia mm-hmm. and say, well, you know, radical Seattle even accepts this. We should implement this statewide. And that's really the game they were playing. But in the process of trying to get the most favorable possible proposal, they actually got a lot more than they were probably expecting to get. Maria mentioned the 500-person threshold for so-called small businesses, and, you know, she mentioned the delayed implementation. She mentioned the tip penalty and the health benefits counting toward that. There are a number of other problems with it, too. One of the more subtle ones, if you look at the charts that the mayor's office put out, they start counting the cost of living increases, which under state law, minimum wage is indexed to the CPI, the Consumer Price Index, which incidentally does not count things like rent and food and healthcare, which are, you know, what poorer people spend a lot of their income on. It doesn't count those things, but it's indexed to that to change so that if the cost of living goes up, the minimum wage also goes up. The clock starts ticking on whether these proposals will count, will be indexed to inflation at the end of the phase-in period, not at the beginning, so that the quote-unquote $15 an hour is really only about $13.50 in wages in 2014 dollars by the time it starts finally kicking in as late as 2025. Above and beyond that...
In other words, inflation erodes the value of it by the time they actually get to $15 an hour.
Yeah, and above and beyond that, in order to get to the $15 an hour, Murray's committee was using an estimate of 2.4% annual inflation increase. The last several years, the average has been more like 1.5, and the Federal Reserve Bank is estimating for the next 10 years that the average will be about 1.87. Now, that doesn't sound like much of a difference, but when it compounds over a year, it's actually a huge difference. So the $15 an hour that they're now claiming, and really they were looking for any way that they could pay as little as possible while hanging the name number 15 on it, it's actually not all that much. There will be some workers under this package that get a raise to $11 and at the beginning of January 2015. That's a good thing. That's actually, you know, going to help some people, but it is a much, much weaker proposal than it is being sold at. Meantime, the committee did manage to peel off a fair amount of organized labor in the support for this, which was one of the strategies, because they're trying to forestall a ballot initiative from going to the ballot. The calculation being that if labor is on record supporting this compromise, then they're not going to open their wallets to help counter all the huge amounts of money that would come in opposition to a 15 now or other group putting initiative on the ballot. 15 Now did get an organization this week from the International Association of Machinists, which is not a radical union and does have a lot of money. But SEIU 775, for example, which is the group that mostly bankrolled the SeaTac proposition last year, David Roth, the head of that, was part of this committee and has signed off on it and is saying, well, you know, the fast food workers are going to get a raise because they don't get any benefits, yeah. So they're on Schedule A.
Groups that organize fast food worker strikes have also signed on to this as well.
And so, you know, again, they managed to divide and conquer on labor, and it's going to make it very difficult to get an initiative passed. So at this point, the battle shifts to city council, which actually has to look at this proposal. The first hearing on it, which will have a public comment period, is on Monday afternoon, the day after tomorrow. And when we get to events, we'll talk about the details of that, because people should show up and really give council an earful over how poor this proposal is.
Mm-hmm. Okay, moving on. Parks District coming up.
Yeah, the City Council on Monday passed unanimously the resolution to send the Parks District initiative to the August ballot. This would create a Parks District that will have the authority to levy property taxes of up to 75 cents per $1,000 assessed property value. So for a homeowner who has a home that's valued at about $400,000, it'd be about $148 per year. That's about double the current assessment that's taken out of your property tax bill for parks. Of course, they can make this a permanent levy, unlike the current levy that comes up for voter approval every 6 years. So in August, it means that voters are going to get potentially your final say on parks funding.
All right. Anything else on that?
Nope. Let's move on.
All right. Governor Inslee coming out with a plan this week.
Yeah, Governor Inslee announced his climate action plan. This is part of the Western States Initiative to deal with climate change. He said right off the bat, of course, that it's going to rely on the state legislature to pass bills to put some of these things into law and to allocate funding to actually make most of it happen. That said, here's what he wants. He basically broke it down into five or six things. First off, he said he wants the legislature to set timeline and targets for cuts in global warming and emissions. Of course, our emissions have already bypassed the federal policy to keep them down for 2020, but we could potentially hit targets for 2030 and 2050. And he would like the legislature to do that. Good luck. Also, he'd like the state legislature to institute a cap and trade program. That was part of his proposal. And he's set up a new task force, his carbon emissions reduction task force, to take testimony and come up with a plan to put before the state legislature for a cap and trade program. And then he had a couple of things to deal with emissions in the state of Washington, first utility emissions. He wants to end the use, he wants public utilities to end the use of coal-fired power plants, which only make up a small amount of our total energy utility production, or our utilities energy production in the state of Washington, but they account for most of the utility related emissions. And in regards to transportation emissions, he wants to get the DOT to support electrifying our transportation system and to put a much bigger emphasis on supporting transit versus roads. And particularly new roads for cars, for gasoline-powered cars and trucks. And then, of course, he wants the legislature to set aside research money for clean energy and for energy-efficient buildings and so forth. So it's actually a pretty good, pretty comprehensive climate plan for the state of Washington. The big question, of course, is will the legislature do anything on it? And given that the House is controlled by the Democrats while the Senate is controlled by the Republicans currently, I doubt that's going to happen.
Well, somewhat related statement out this week from the state DNR.
Yeah, the Department of Natural Resources is announcing that it's putting a timber sale near the Oso landslide from last month on hold. The Riley Roto, I want to say Roto Rooter, the Riley Roto timber sale is on hold for additional review. Now, the slopes there are so steep they'd have to be hauled by helicopter, and there are signs of previous landslide activity in the area. But
well, that's
that doesn't
a good sign.
Yeah, but that doesn't stop the DNR, because just a few days before the Oso slide, there was another sale about 20 miles west of Oso, also helicopter logging, also prior landslide activity, slopes of about 65 degrees, that is to say more than two-thirds of the way to sheer vertical instead of sheer horizontal. Mm-hmm. Local residents objected to that because of the landslide potential. So the DNR took 6 acres out of the 2,200-acre timber sale and then sold the other 194. So this is progress, kind of. It's just a shame that a square mile of mud and any number of deaths had to lead to it.
All right. Moving on, jumping to national, starting out with the NBA and Donald Sterling.
Yeah, we had a fascinating cultural moment this week with owner of the Los Angeles Clippers, Donald Sterling, with a tape that was leaked last weekend showing his overt racial bigotry. Lo and behold, within 72 hours, the NBA had decided to give him a lifetime ban and to force him to sell his team. Now, this sounds like a really strong and decisive statement against racism, but it wasn't. It was a strong and decisive statement that when big corporations start pulling their sponsorships from a major sports league, that's what gets their attention. Because the irony here, Sterling has been an owner in the league for over 30 years. He bought his franchise for $12 million in 1981, probably sell it for over $1 billion now, which that'll teach him. When he paid out the largest housing discrimination settlement in Justice Department history, it was fine with the NBA. When he was sued for sexual harassment by an employee, you know, boys will be boys. When he testified in oath under oath that he treated a former girlfriend like a whore, that kind of minor suspension from the NBA, but it was no biggie. When his Elgin Baylor, who's a Hall of Fame player and was his general manager for a long time, African-American and from Seattle, Baylor sued him for discrimination, alleging that he ran the Clippers like a plantation, but that didn't get much attention. Numerous past accounts of racist comments and actions, nasty rumors that Sterling is the real victim here. But when, you know, a racist billionaire with a hot 20-something black Mexican girlfriend, he's not the real victim here, Will, although you heard a lot of conservative pundits saying that this week. But, when big companies start pulling their sponsorships, then we got to do something. So now we know what the key to societal change is.
And developments this week in the U.S. Senate.
Yeah, a number of them. Chuck Schumer, a Democratic senator from New York, who basically is a senator from Wall Street, is the point person now to introduce a constitutional amendment to overturn the Citizens United decision in the Senate. which is kind of remarkable given where most of his funding is from. And he's also the chair of the Democratic Senate committee that oversees fundraising for senatorial candidates. So it's a very interesting choice of him to be the point person on this, and you would really want to see the wording on this before getting too excited. But it is remarkable, and it's not going to go anywhere because it will get blocked in the Senate and the House won't even look at it. But it is still good, actually, that they're at least talking about this at the national level within the mainstream Democratic Party. Speaking of things that can't get through the Senate, we found out this week that the minimum wage increase being espoused by President Obama can't get through the Senate. Republicans filibustered that bill, and it went down 42 to 54, needing 60 votes to overcome the filibuster. Even though it had no chance of getting a vote in the House, every Republican but one voted to not even consider it in the Senate, which, you know, when you're talking about big business versus ordinary workers, shows pretty clearly which side they're on.
And I believe the Restaurant Association played some pretty heavy lobbying on that.
I'm shocked.
Yeah.
No, actually, I'm not.
All right. Well, speaking of food, organic regulations.
Yeah, and speaking of sellouts, too, because as with many Obama appointees over his year and term and a half, the person he's got heading the Department of Agriculture, Tom Vilsack, is a former governor of Iowa, who owes much of his political career to Archer Daniels Midland. And that's showing up now in how the Agriculture Department and specifically the USDA is trying to hijack regulations for organics and how organics are labeled. Now, there was a bill passed in law passed in 2005 under the Bush administration, ironically enough, that sets standards for organic foods. It's done through something called the National Organics Standards Board. And so the USDA now trying to stack the NOSB board with industry representatives and then putting a proposal in to allow synthetic ingredients, that is to say non-organic ingredients, to be permanently allowed in organic foods. Now, this is possible now if there's no substitute that can be found for them, if two-thirds of the National Organic Standards Board agrees that they should be allowed. Otherwise, they were automatically sunsetted. This is being flipped now. The proposal now is that they can be kept in permanently unless two-thirds of the board votes to remove them from the list of acceptable ingredients. So, once again, big agribusiness trying to essentially put non-organic stuff in your organic food, which is pretty disturbing for anybody who cares about what goes in their bodies.
All right, moving on to this week's economic news.
Yeah, this week Bank of America admitted that it made a $4 billion accounting mistake. Now, I looked at their explanation for what they were doing wrong, and I have to admit I don't really understand what they were doing in the first place, which I think is a very good indication that they shouldn't have been doing it in the first place. Really. It's not illegal, apparently. There was a rule change back in 2007 that allowed them to book items as an unrealized gain or loss instead of posting them as an increase or decrease to their capital on their balance sheet, in other words, a realized loss.
I wonder who lobbied for that change.
Yeah, uh-huh. But the Financial Accounting Standards Board, that's FASB, is in the process of changing that rule because they recognize that it is a problem and that it distorts the value of a bank's holdings. And so, you know, you look at this and the first question that comes to mind is how did the Fed miss this when they were doing their stress tests? It really puts into question whether or not the stress tests have any meaning at all. And secondly, you know, particularly since Bank of America just passed their stress test in March with flying colors. And now the Fed had to come back and say, look, you made a $4 billion accounting mistake that's changed the value of your capital. Well, sorry, now we have to take that back and say that you didn't pass your stress test. The fact that the error went undetected for years and was only recently found by a lower level Bank of America accountants who are preparing their quarterly SEC filings is another indication that there's something wrong in the Bank of America accounting system. It proves also that some banks are just too darn big when, you know, a $4 billion error can get overlooked for so long.
A billion here, a billion there.
A billion here, a billion there. What, you know,
pretty soon you're talking real money.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think we need Glass-Steagall back. And then also this week, the GAO, the nonpartisan General Accounting Office report came out this week on last year's settlement of the foreclosure abuse by big banks. It suggests that the federal prosecutors underestimated the error rate that big banks had on their foreclosure proceedings, and that they settled for a much lower dollar figure than they should have. Now, the error rate that they assumed banks had made with their foreclosure proceedings on each case, they put it about 6.5%. And that was supposed to determine the number of homeowners that would need relief, and it would determine the dollar amount of the settlement. Well, the real error rate was probably much closer to 24%, which is about four times four times the amount of the error rate that they used. They've also found, too, from looking at the settlement last year, that about 20% of homeowners, the recipients of money from the settlement, are not getting their money because they simply can't be found, and the banks are not doing enough to try to locate those people.
I'm wondering if, like, air traffic controllers have a 24% error rate, what that would look like.
That would be a mess.
All right.
Yes.
Finally, on national marriage equality.
Yeah, good news, because, you know, we like to throw in some of that every now and then. Megan Gallagher, who is the founder of the National Organization for Marriage, which is the right-wing group that has really spearheaded a lot of the constitutional amendments and laws passed in different states, mostly red states, but blue states as well, to try and prevent marriage equality. She threw in the towel this week. She acknowledged that the right wing has not just losing, but has lost that battle, and that supporters should move on, not that they'll take her advice. The direct quote, "Most people who believe in the classic understanding of marriage are in shock. They are awed by the powers now shutting down debate and by our ineffectualness in responding to these developments. The temptation is to shout and yell and stamp our feet in ineffectual ridiculousness. That is understandable, but is to be resisted. Hiding or pretending is not going to help us now. We have to face the truth, and we have to find the love at its heart." Of course, rather than finding the love at its heart, chances are a lot of the right wing will continue to shout and yell and stamp their feet in ridiculousness. But it's nice that at least she is having some movement on this.
A moment of clarity, let's
yes.
say.
All right. Moving on to international, starting with Egypt.
Yeah, another crackdown in Egypt. Now, usually when you look at a dictatorship, one of the big features of a dictatorship is a corrupt justice system, one that is open to abuse. This week, a second mass death sentence was issued in the province of Minya in Egypt. They sentenced 680 people in one trial that lasted just a few minutes to death engaging in a riot in Edwa that involved ransacking a police station and the death of one police officer. In that group of 680 people who were sentenced to death was the top spiritual leader of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. This is a historical first. Usually in Egypt, they might crack down on the followers, but they tend not to crack down too hard on the spiritual leaders. Particularly because the spiritual leaders can't be demonstrated that they actually engaged in violence. And in this case, Mohammed Badi, the head of the Muslim Brotherhood, who was sentenced to death, was not in Edwa at the time of the riot. It's been proven that he was in Cairo at the time, and that during the time of the riots, he was actually publicly advocating for nonviolence in all of his statements. So this is very clearly a political crackdown. So, and I should also point out that some of the defendants were far too old and too frail to have taken part in any street demonstration, especially one that involved ransacking a police station. So very clearly, it's not just a crackdown politically, it's also the attempt to get rid of the elders of a community in a province that has a lot of support for the Muslim Brotherhood.
And that doesn't have anything to do with the U.S., though.
Oh, yes, it does, because this week Egypt's foreign minister was also in Washington, D.C., lobbying to get more military aid for the government of Egypt, and he was getting a particularly warm welcome from the Republicans.
Yeah, and on a very similar theme, speaking of authoritarian governments, the German government blocked Edward Snowden this week from giving personal evidence in front of a parliamentary inquiry into NSA surveillance, and that was just hours before Angela Merkel, their chancellor, which is equivalent of a prime minister, traveled to D.C. for a meeting with President Obama. So we don't just do those things with countries we think of as totalitarian states.
Mm-hmm. All right. And also briefly, Nigeria.
Yeah. Folks may be aware a couple of weeks ago there was a mass kidnapping in northeast Nigeria where there's a Islamist insurgency going on. 232 schoolgirls taking their final exam to try and graduate from the equivalent of a high school were kidnapped by the Islamist groups Boko Haram. Eyewitnesses reporting this week that those girls have been sold off as wives to militants for the equivalent of about $12 each. There's been almost no U.S. media attention to this, even though it's been a big story in the rest of the world. You know, if they were in the Ukraine or above a 747, then it disappeared. You know, maybe there would have been...
Or a ferry that overturned.
Yeah, but, you know, it's Africa, so who cares? But the thing is, again, there's a lot of U.S. involvement in this particular conflict. You know, they're supporting and militarily supporting a corrupt government that has done almost nothing to try and locate the schoolgirls. And it's a region of the country where the U.S. military and the CIA are hugely active. A lot of this is continues to be fallout and blowback from the NATO involvement in overthrowing the government in Libya. You know, all through the Sahara, we saw this last year in Mali and with the kidnapping there, and now in northeast Nigeria, a tremendous amount of small arms and training for militants came out of the Libyan conflict, and it spilled over into other parts of Western Africa.
Yeah, and plus the State Department is saying now that after having beheaded al-Qaeda in Pakistan and Afghanistan, that many of its quote-unquote affiliated groups don't get the same kind of financial support from the leadership that they used to, and now they've turned to criminal activity like kidnapping for money, as they have in this case.
Yeah, but again, because it's Africa, you know, any foreign correspondence from U.S. media outlets are in either Cairo or Johannesburg, which is a long, long way from West Africa.
Mm-hmm. All right. Events.
Yeah, today, this weekend, Saturday and Sunday, Seattle TILF is having their edible plant sale at Meridian Park at 4649 Sunnyside Avenue North behind the Good Shepherd Center from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. both days. So go and get your vegetables, herbs, flowers, seeds, fruit trees, and other
Yeah, the Good
goodies.
Shepherd Center is on Sunnyside, but actually the Meridian Park is on the Meridian Street
on the
side.
Meridian side.
50th and Meridian basically would be where to start to go. And it's a great sale. It's a huge event for people who want things to plant.
Mm-hmm. All right. Other things?
Oh, yeah. Today, all day from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m., there's the 28th Amendment National Roadshow, which is a group, once again, that's trying to work for nationally for a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United. They're being hosted by WAMEND, the good folks there. That'll be all day today at University Temple United Methodist Church, 43rd and 15th Northeast in the U District. On Monday, May 5th at 2:30 in the afternoon, that's the public comment period and initial city council review of Mayor Murray's minimal wage proposal. So go there and come a little early to sign up and make your voice heard on that. Monday night, your guest from 7:30 is speaking at LA Bay. Is that correct?
Yes, Arun Gupta. He will be speaking on labor issues at 7 p.m.
You're okay. Correct. And Tuesday, the Give Big Foundation, Seattle Foundation. is doing its annual Give Big Day when literally at this point a couple thousand different nonprofits are participating from throughout Puget Sound, where the Seattle Foundation gives a certain percentage match to donations that are given on that day. So it's become this huge event. If
so
you are
getting the SeattleFoundation.org website, find your group on their list and donate through their page on Tuesday, the 6th of May, and the Seattle Foundation will match some of your gift.
Yep. On Wednesday, there's a hearing for MetroCuts, correct?
Yeah, from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Garfield Community Center on 23rd and Cherry in their multipurpose room. It's a Seattle City Council hearing where you can give your input on Seattle's transportation budget. So go and tell them that what it is that you think we need to do with our transportation system.
And then finally, on Thursday, May 8th at 7 o'clock, two arguments for non-human animal rights will be held with Dr. Dan Dombrowski, who's a professor of philosophy at Seattle U. The arguments are sentiency, which presumably includes the idea that they're not corporations. If corporations can be considered people, then, things that are actually alive should be as well. And then marginal cases also. Anyway, that is part of the installment at Common Good Cafe at the University of Temple United Methodist Church, 43rd and 15th Northeast in the U District, 7 p.m. on Thursday the 8th.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org.
All right.